Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, how professional and amateur sports responds to mental illness. We've had a window into this issue with Vikings player Everson Griffin's struggles with his mental health last week. The details are quite public. Griffin's family has asked for privacy. What we're interested in today is what the Vikings did about Griffin's troubles and how sports teams, professional, collegiate, even junior teams respond to mental health needs and the idea of wellness. Think about what former Green Bay Packers player Aaron Taylor told ESPN when he was asked about depression. He said it'd be easier to start with which ones do not have depression. Two guests to help guide the conversation and your own experience with this. If you were a student athlete or a professional athlete, did your team leaders have an open door policy about mental health? And if you're a coach, how do you talk to your team about mental health issues and mental wellness? So I'd like to get a large amount of experience on this, different perspectives on this. If you've been a student athlete, is this something that came up when you were on a team? If you're the parent of a student athlete, do you have a sense as to whether the coach is talking to the athletes about mental health and mental wellness? And if you're a coach, I'd like to hear about how that comes up in your conversation. Do you have the kind of open door policy that you think your athletes could come to you to talk to you about an issue with this? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, wherever you are in the five-state region here, and on Twitter, at CarrieMPR. Brent Walker is with us. He's the Associate Athletics Director at Columbia University, and he joins us from New York. And Brent, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Angel Brutus is with us, Director of Counseling and Sports Psychology at Mississippi State University, and with us from Starkville, Mississippi. And Angel, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me as well.
Angel, I don't think the details of what happened here with Mr. Griffin are especially important, but I'd like you to tell me what you hear in this. The Vikings development director told the police department that Griffin had been, quote, struggling for weeks. We don't know all the details of how the Vikings responded to that, but does that raise questions for you about how any team, professional or not, might step in, how they would handle something like this?
Well, I think it's a very interesting telltale sign, especially if it's been observable from multiple sources that an individual, quote-unquote, has been struggling for weeks, you know, without knowing the specifics or the details. But ultimately, what we try to do is educate different coaches as well as allied staff members to always be a noticer of if an individual's behaviors are changing. And I think that's the ultimate thing for a lot of us to look for, is the change in behavior. That can be a telltale sign for things to kind of look out for. I think it would also be a little reckless on my end as a clinician and a practitioner to assume that there are ways to prevent. I think one of the misnomers in terms of when it comes to mental health, specifically if there's issues in terms of suicidal ideation or behaviors, is that there's this ultimate one-stop approach to being able to, quote-unquote, prevent, depending on the type of approach an individual takes and the lethality that's there and the type of planning that might take place. Some individuals, it is impulsive. Other individuals, it's a long-term plan. And so it really is difficult to speak a lot about any preventative actions without knowing the full details of that particular case.
Okay. Two good things to pull out there, but I'm going to grab a call here from Thor in Glencoe, Minnesota. Hi, Thor. You're an athlete now. Is that right?
No, I used to be an athlete.
Yeah, tell me your experience with this issue of mental health. Did your coaches, encourage your fellow athletes to notice what was going on? How did it work?
I actually made it through 1 year of college due to my undiagnosed depression and anxiety. My coaches on the cross-country and track teams, they had an open-door policy, but ultimately it was up to us to come to them with our struggles and let them know what was going on.
So how did that, was that encouraging, do you think, to you and some of your fellow athletes? Or was it, if it's all in our hands, most of the time we're not going to show up in the coach's office to say what's going on?
I think that if you're able to be motivated to get the help that you need, that open door policy is great and helpful. But if you're really struggling and you can't bring yourself to get the help on your own, just having the open door policy isn't enough, and you need to do outreach as a coach.
I'm really glad for the call, Thor. Brent, does that resonate with you?
Yeah, I think the challenge there, and I think it's first and foremost, it's wonderful when coaches do have open door policies, but a couple things related to that is that oftentimes coaches aren't really sure what to do with the information. So it's important for, I think, an organization to have a plan of attack. And going back to what Angel said as well, being able to notice when something is problematic or a potential concern, or maybe a potential concern for the future, and then having a specific protocol of how to get in touch with professionals. And that's going to vary by organization. Some organizations are going to have professionals in-house. In other cases, it's going to be a referral process. But making sure that everyone is trained in that referral process, because I think the reality of it, when someone is going through a mental health issue, in many cases, people aren't in a state of mind where they're capable of actively seeking out help. And that's where the organizational structure becomes important.
You know what Angel said about making sure that people are noticers, right? That they feel empowered. I mean, you know, in some ways you can see kids thinking this could damage, let's say it's high school, this could damage my fellow teammates, you know, opportunities in college, or what is this going to mean for his record? It's a lot of responsibility to put on kids.
100%. And I think part of that too, and I think there's misinformation about what does that mean if it goes on a record? What if I'm diagnosed with a mental health issue?
Yeah.
And obviously this case with the Vikings is a worst case scenario because it gets out to the public. So it in many ways, it exacerbates that concern of, oh my gosh, everyone's going to find out. But the reality is, and this is when it's in most cases the way it should be, all that information is confidential. So people aren't going to know that you're actively getting help. But in sport, and especially in professional sport, that is a huge cause for concern, is that can confidentiality be maintained? And then how do we set up systems so that it does, the confidentiality is maintained?
I have to say, Angel, it is regretful the way this information about Everson Griffin came out, because there were incidents, the police were called. That is not the way that anybody would want some kind of, you know, necessary therapy, some kind of needed help to trigger events like that, right? The public nature of it and the stigma, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes. I understand that is why, as Brent was saying, people think it's a secret to be held, right? And I'm just not going to and I'm going to deal with it myself. You probably find a lot of student athletes or athletes who believe they can handle it.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, no mistake about it, the sport culture itself, you know, you're conditioned and trained to be able to work through the toughness of everything. And so, you know, when you are considering help-seeking behaviors, that's almost like the antithesis to being, quote-unquote, mentally tough on the surface. But I think it's also important that as we continue to normalize the conversation surrounding behavioral health and what that looks like early on in the process, I think that helps to move the needle a little bit. I know that what we've done here at Mississippi State so far has gotten some really good feedback in terms of our student population. We've incorporated a lot of our behavioral health screening options as a part of their physical screening, in that information is held close to the breast, as, you know, Brett has eloquently stated in terms of confidentiality. Only my eyes in my department are the ones that sees individuals who may be flagged as potential concerns or individuals that we might need to monitor. And so early on in the introduction of coming on campus, these students are now exposed to being able to articulate some of their mental health concerns based off of different screeners that we have.
And again, you're saying that that happens when you get your, what, a yearly physical or your assessment, your physical assessment to be on the team.
Absolutely. And it's not just our new students. It's also transfer students as well as our returners. We've been able to implement that across all of our up to 400 student athletes.
You know, Brent, what Angel was saying about the culture of sports teams, particularly professional and collegiate, I was reading something that Vikings player Kyle Rudolph was talking about in an interview to the Star Trib. And he said, you have to be so mentally tough to play this game. If you're not in a clear state of mind, it's got to be hard to go out there and perform. So not only, perhaps, are you holding this as a secret, but you're also worried about, you know, it day to day, it impairing the clarity of your judgment in super high pressure moments, you know, like competitive sports.
Yeah. And, you know, in the past year, what's happened as well with DeMar DeRozan and Kevin Love coming out and talking about their experiences, DeMar DeRozan with depression and Kevin Love talking about his panic attacks and anxiety, it highlights a really important point, and one that I think is very difficult for athletes to come to terms with. And when DeRozan came out and talked about his depression, he was averaging 29 points a game. And Kevin Love, when he came out and talked about his panic attacks, he highlighted the fact that in his next game, he scored 32 points. And so athletes are, as you said, you know, it's this concept of you have to be mentally tough, you have to overcome adversity. But for an athlete, when you are performing so well, then you also have that question, is there really something wrong with me?
Right.
But, and so it puts an interesting dilemma to the athlete of, well, I must be all right because I'm still performing. But then for some people, there is that concern of, well, maybe it will impact my performance. That could be a motivator or a demotivator to get help. But I think it's important because for some athletes, their sport may be their sanctuary, where as bad as life is, as depressed as they are, it may be the one thing that they're still able to do. For others, it may be that may be the first sign that they need help, as it has filtered into their sport. But that's just a difficult part of that, because it doesn't always impact their performance. It may, but it also may not. But it doesn't mean that there's not a problem that needs to be addressed.
Brent Walker with us, if you've just tuned in, current Associate Athletics Director at Columbia, and Angel Brutus with us, Director of Counseling and Sports Psychology at Mississippi State University. This is a conversation that comes from the headlines recently about Everson Griffin's struggles with mental health, and it took a very public path. We are not talking about the details of his case, but we thought this would be a good moment for a discussion about how sports teams, whether it's professional or collegiate, I'm especially interested in high school and junior sports teams, how they handle this idea of mental health and mental wellness. What's the coach's role in that? What's the fellow teammates' role? What are parents' roles? I'm asking you, if you're the parent of a student athlete, do you know whether your child's coach has an open door policy about mental health and wellness? If you've been through this yourself, maybe you were a student athlete in college, did you feel like you could confide what was happening with anxiety or depression or other mental illnesses? Do you think the teams handle this well? We see some testimony here from NFL players that the NFL really hasn't yet gotten its act together on having this kind of an open door policy. I'd like to know what your own experience is with this. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR, where Carrie says, My kid's coach was extremely supportive of us while she was struggling with depression, told us she was always welcome to swim, no matter if she competed, told us that getting therapy and treatment was priority number one, a good coach and a good person, to Chris in Minneapolis. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. What's your experience with this?
Well, I'd like to just follow up on a couple of things that have been said. My role currently is I'm a certified peer support specialist, meaning that I've gone through a certification process from the state based on my lived experience with mental illness and substance use disorder. From that training, I've also become a instructor for mental health first aid, which is seemingly a newer program in the United States. Being here for less than 10 years, it was brought over from Australia, developed in 2006. And really what mental health first aid is, and there are many different veins for it, mental health first aid for adults, for older adults, for those who serve youth, for first responders. I just came back from last week teaching a course to some nursing home staff in southern Minnesota, and realizing that even clinicians without enough training for understanding the symptoms and the signs of someone who may be at a greater risk for developing a mental health crisis can miss those signs as maybe being a part of something else that the athlete might be dealing with,
such as
fatigue, which is a key sign for that, that might just be part of how hard they're working within that.
So, Chris, if I might, since we have other people that want to speak to this, do I hear you saying this can be sometimes difficult to recognize? And are the coaches and the teachers who are interacting with these athletes getting the kind of training that they need? Is that right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And I think this very simple training that can be offered pretty much anywhere, and normally for free, I'm able to offer it through grants from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration and also the DHS.
I'm going to put that to our guests. Angel, what about that? I mean, sometimes these can be difficult signs to see, and people are not properly trained to spot it and do something about it.
Absolutely. I definitely agree with that. I think part of the issue also, unfortunately, is the fear of broaching the topic. When it comes to suicidality, you have to be concrete and very specific in the talks that you have with an individual that you might be concerned about. Any kind of vague approach to the topic has to be put to the side. You have to be very bold and
Angel, give me an example of that. What's some vague approach to this that doesn't work?
And so a lot of it has to do with just specifically working within the athletic population in general. Athletes have a tendency to, for the most part, recognize the confidence level of the person sitting in front of them.
Okay.
So whether you're a practitioner or a clinician who's trained, or whether you're a coach or an allied staff member, if they sense any level of lack of confidence in being able to say, hey, I really need to ask you some really tough questions, and I need for you to be 100% honest with me.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had thoughts of, ending your life? Do you have thoughts of hopelessness? Do you have concerns where you're not able to have future-oriented thinking? Those are some real concrete questions to be able to ask. It's not enough to just, say, hey, how are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
That's a very vague approach to a real serious concern that you might have for someone. Because, oftentimes, specifically what I said earlier, is when a person has made up their mind to end their life, there's actually a sense of relief that comes with it. And so while we may be afraid to broach the conversation when they're in the downward spiral, it's those moments where they are completely elated and they have almost like this sense of resolve that are the peak moments to really identify where they've already made up in their mind that they have a plan and they have a sense of relief and everything is going to be okay soon. And so just being extremely mindful of that, and I think the previous caller who talked about the mental health first aid really has touched on a lot. There are things that people can do in terms of QPR training. You don't have to be a clinician to be able to be trained in some of this stuff. And, one of the things that we always emphasize and advocate for, again, is being comfortable with the conversation, not shying away from it, helps tremendously. I think the other thing to also really take into consideration is that, you know, no matter what you do, if a person has made up their mind to do it, and they have a plan, they have a means, those are the types of questions that you need to ask. It's not just do you have a plan, but what is your plan? What is the duration for your plan? Like, do you have a set time or a location? You've got to get really specific in these questions.
Yeah. Eric says, my son's had the benefit of many good coaches that appreciated the, quote, molding young men role, but I never heard anything specific from my boys about mental health. I do believe my college son gets some of that in his one-on-ones with his position coach, however. Brent, what do you think of the parents' role in this? Is this something that parents can be probing for when their kids are playing sports, at whatever level?
Yeah, I think and what the research shows us, too, is that, especially for college athletes, is that they're most likely to reach out to a friend or a family member. Unfortunately, because I think, and it goes back to the stigma we've talked about, they're probably going to reach out to a coach or a family member before they reach out to a professional. As a parent, what you're listening for is those changes in behavior. Is your son or daughter more withdrawn? Have they lost an interest in things that they were typically interested in?
Mm-hmm.
And looking for some of those changes beyond performance, because obviously transitioning to college, it's difficult. It's difficult as an athlete, so performance is going to suffer. But some of those activities that they enjoyed outside of sport, whether that be related to music or the things that they just regularly did for fun, are they no longer excited about those things? Have they completely lost interest in those? You're looking in those types of changes. Are they not talking to the friends that they normally talk to? So some of those telltale signs that there may be something going on.
The other thing, and I don't think I was specific enough in the question, I'm also interested in whether parents should be on the alert for coaches or teacher coaches who are not or are, you know, providing this access. I guess I'm asking this because maybe your child would tell the coach something that they might not reveal to you. Is this something that parents can look for? Like, what kind of a relationship, what kinds of things does that coach talk about when it comes to mental health or not?
I think it's difficult in terms of coaches probably aren't going to, well, it depends on the department. Sometimes they are going to openly discuss mental health and discuss the policies. That's the ideal scenario. That's not going to be the case every place.
Okay.
But I think what you're looking for in coaches is, let's say, for instance, somebody suffers a head injury. They have a concussion. And what we know about concussions is that there are, for instance, depression is associated with a concussion. How does a coach respond if you are feeling down and that you are showing signs of being hopeless? Are you getting a coach that is responding to that and trying to connect you to resources, or are you getting a response that a coach is saying, hey, this is part of the grind, you have to suck it up and get back in there? So listening to through your children's response, what is the response they're getting from the coaches? I think that's going to be one of the main indicators.
Marissa says, I used to be a student athlete, and I've coached a summer youth swimming league. I have diagnosed depression and anxiety. I was lucky to have a coach who cared, but it's hard to see what's going on with kids unless they come up and tell you. To Alex in St. Cloud, and Alex, it sounds like you have experience on both sides of this. Is that right?
Yes, I do.
What's your experience?
I was a student athlete in college, and okay. I was diagnosed with an eating disorder my freshman year. And I was lucky enough to have a coach who, at the time, I didn't really appreciate it, but she said, you really need to take, you know, a medical leave and go home and get some proper resources. And it felt like I was being punished at the time, but I think, you know, she might have very well saved my life.
So your coach saw something and was able to intervene, I don't know, what your friends, maybe even your teammates, couldn't.
Yeah. My teammate actually noticed, you know, things first, and she reported to my coach, and I think they, you know, came up with a plan that was going to be in my best interest.
What did you think about taking that advice and leaving school at the time. Did you blame her? How long did it take you to realize that what you've just said, that she may have saved your life?
You know, at the time, I felt like I was being taken away from my team. I was being taken away from my studies. I was being taken out of, you know, where I wanted to be. But I think I was so close to it that I couldn't see just how much help I needed. And it took me several years to really be grateful for, you know, the life that I have now, because someone intervened early and said, let's get you the resources you need.
So how would you handle that today as a coach?
Yeah, so I coach swimming, and one of the things that I try to do is be really proactive about communicating with parents and with the students' teachers. The teachers have kind of figured out by now that I frequently check in with these kids' teachers and just ask how things are going, how grades are. And the teachers have been really great about responding to me and saying, so-and-so was, you know, really sleepy during class today. I think, you know, he or she really needs, you know, to talk to someone about this.
Yeah. I'm really glad you heard the show and called, Alex. Thanks. Angel, I assume that's the direct approach you were talking about a few minutes ago.
Yeah, definitely. And I think she hit on a couple of different areas of points of entry when it comes to supporting a student athlete as or athlete, whether it's a student or a professional, in terms of seeking help. Normally, it's the individuals within the social circle. So it's the teammates, because they spend the most the majority of amount of time together. They are the ones that really have a great pulse of what's really going on with their teammate. And part of that process also is, you know, what do different organizations put in place to be able to foster relationships with individuals such as myself and such as, you know, Dr. Walker, when it comes to being a part of institutional organizations. And so, you know, here at Mississippi State, I have a great fortune of being able to have a collaborative relationship with a number of different both on-campus partnerships as well as within our department. And part of that process, I serve as a liaison with our Student Athlete Advisory Council, and I kind of liaise for their health and health, physical and mental health promotion committee, which is really student-run. And so it's a student-athlete-run portion of our advisory council, and these students are the ones that are at the forefront of really giving us a sense, you know, as an administrator, a pulse of what's really going on with our student athletes. And from there, they are also being trained to be noticers. And so we're constantly having conversations about what that looks like. And it's not uncommon now for a student to reach out to me and say, hey, I'm really concerned about my teammate. However, I don't know how to have this conversation with them. Can you at least check on them for me?
Right.
And so I'll do an inadvertent check-in with the student, and also honoring the fact that their teammate reached out but wanted to remain anonymous. And so that's another you know, opportunity that I've been very fortunate to be able to forge those kinds of relationships with our students, who really understand the benefit of reaching out and seeking the help, not just for themselves, but for their cohorts as well.
Here's Peg, who kind of had an opposite experience as Alex. She says, I have a daughter who played very high-level competitive soccer. She developed an eating disorder, as what Alex was telling us about. She was not supported or directed by her coaches or teammates. As a senior, she had to give up the sport for her own health. If you've just tuned into the show, it's a conversation about the role of coaches and sports teams in athletic mental health and mental wellness, a conversation ignited by the situation with Vikings player Everson Griffin. Details of that, the family would prefer that that remains private. We're asking, what's the role of the team? What's the role of the coach and the teammates? Do many teams, professional all the way down to high school and junior, have the kind of open door policies that they should about mental health? Getting some insight here from Angel Brutus from Mississippi State University and Brent Walker from Columbia, but also hearing from you this morning, if you were a student athlete or a professional athlete, did your team and your coaches have an open door policy about this? Is it something that you felt like you could seek help for? If you're the parent of a student athlete, maybe someone who has encountered some of these mental health problems, how did the coach respond? How did the team respond? 651-227-6000 on Twitter at CarrieNPR, and wherever you are in the region, 800 1-800-242-2828. We'll get a look at the latest news when we come back. I also want to talk with our guests, Brent and Angel, about the message that the professional athletic culture sends about mental health. Does it send this message? Yes, you can seek help. Does it send a message that says, suck it up and be tough? We'll talk with our guests about that and you on the other side of news. To Stephen John now. Hi, Stephen.
Morning, Carrie. Mark Judge, a high school friend of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, has completed his interview with FBI agents. His attorney wouldn't say what Judge was asked as part of the reopened background investigation into Kavanaugh. College professor Christine Blasey Ford has said Judge was in the room when a drunken Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her in the early 1980s. Judge has denied the allegations, as has Kavanaugh. Desperation has exploded into anger 4 days after an earthquake and tsunami severely damaged parts of an Indonesian island. Residents are showing frustration at the pace of rescues, grabbing food from damaged stores and begging for help. The confirmed death toll exceeds 1,200, with hundreds severely injured and still more trapped in debris. Some places have received little aid due to impassable roads. Amazon is boosting its minimum wage for all U.S. workers to $15 an hour starting next month. And the online retail giant said it will push for an increase in the federally mandated minimum wage, which now stands at $7.25 per hour. Amazon was facing political and economic pressure to raise pay for thousands of employees. The wage hike also comes at a time the company needs to hire holiday workers amid the tightest job market in nearly two decades. Amazon stock is up a fraction in midday trading on the broader market. The Dow was up 120 points. Highs today, mid-50s to low 60s across the state, cooler in the Arrowhead. This is Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 11:38.
Programming is supported by Securian Financial, offering insurance, investment, and retirement solutions that give you the confidence to enjoy the here and now, so you can make every moment count. Learn more at Securian.com.
On the next NPR News Presents, former Vice President Walter Mondale and longtime civil rights activist Josie Johnson talk about their involvement in the struggle for fair housing, civil rights, and voting rights. That's today at noon and 9 p.m.
Sure, you could wait to hear these Talking Volumes conversations on the radio, or you could be in the room when I interviewed Leif Enger tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, and Rebecca Traister on October 17th. Just a few tickets left for each show. There's an energy and electricity in being in the room when this happens, and I'd like to see you there. Fitz Box Office for tickets.
Programming supported by Bassford Remley, whose trial lawyers meet the legal challenges of a wide spectrum of corporate clients here in Minnesota and across the nation. Bassford Remley, a fresh approach to an age-old practice. More at Bassford.com.
Back to the discussion now and to the phones to Nikki in Blaine. Hey, Nikki, thanks so much for waiting. What's your experience with this?
Well, my experience, I have he's now 9-year-old and experienced some bullying in school when he was 7. And he's a hockey player. Mm-hmm. And so he got through, he wound up being diagnosed with an anxiety disorder, went through some counseling through school. But he was so down about his self-confidence that he's like, I want to quit hockey because I'm not any good.
Ah.
Well, gratefully for us and thankfully for us, he had this amazing coach that, we had been forthcoming and said, this is kind of what's going on. And, this is what he's thinking. And he actually sat down and talked to my son. And he's like, look, bud, whatever happens in school, that's fine. But you know what? You're a good hockey player. You deserve to be here. You need to get out there. And he actually responded really well. And we spent about the last 2 years rebuilding his confidence and his abilities, and it's paid off because now he's been waved up a level in hockey, and he's on a AAA team that he really, really, really wanted to be on. So,
Nikki, yeah, that sounds like a really formative experience at a young age for your son. I mean, it could have gone either way, right?
Right, right. And he's a very kind-hearted, like soft-hearted kid. So we were just like, okay, this is going to be, it's going to be make or break for him, kind of like his outlook on things. And, thankfully people around us in the school were able to support him and get him through it. And he's thriving now. So it was a very good thing, but it really opened my eyes to how it can affect somebody that young.
Good to have your call. So, Brent, I hear her when she says this is kind of a make or break thing at age 9. I mean, here's what we're talking about is confidence level, not just in sports, but, you know, in everything else, right? Academics and a lot of different parts of your life. And that's a big deal at that age.
Yeah, 100%. I think one thing that's critical that she said, too, they went to the coach and had an open conversation and let the coach know what he was dealing with. Because if the coach didn't know that background information, he may assume that his withdrawal at practice is simply a lack of interest, a lack of motivation, when in fact, you know, he was dealing with a very serious bullying issue outside of his sport. And mm-hmm. so that open communication is critical in helping the coach handle the situation, handle the way practice goes. But yeah, it's definitely the case where the sport aspect can be a definite confidence builder.
Angel, what do you think the professional sports industry, what kind of message do you think it often sends to kids Nikki's age or young, you know, athletes who aspire to something in college or beyond?
Well, I think it also kind of goes back to what was mentioned earlier with one of the other callers in terms of the anticipation of what this looks like if I have something on my record, because I do have these aspirations to pursue sport at the next level, whether it's pursuing it at the collegiate level or pursuing it at the professional level, where the rosters are not as heavy and deep in terms of the depth chart. And so the higher up the level of sport participation, the more critical an athlete may be in terms of making sure that they have a quote-unquote clean record. I think it begs to differ just because this is a fishbowl culture, which means on the surface level it looks like there's a lot of poking and prodding in terms of professional athletes and living on a certain stage where they're pretty vulnerable to other people's opinions and people thinking that they know what's going on with them.
Right.
But I think it's also important for professional organizations to emphasize and really be honest about the level of background work that's being done. I think it's time to move the needle of the conversation when it comes to behavioral health concerns and not just addressing issues from a PR perspective when things are happening and people have questions about the organization, but really being more proactive in educating the public about some of their programming that they do have in place, you know, like your rookie success programming that takes place within the NFL. The NFL actually has a former player who takes on the role of, when it comes to developing mental health programs and making connections with community-based providers to provide support services for a lot of their players, whether it's with the NFLPA or not. And this is just the NFL in general. But there are a lot of programs that are actually being built upon right now, but it's just not getting a lot of publicity for it. We only hear about the mental health concerns within pro sports when it becomes a crisis.
That's issue. Exactly right. Yeah, exactly.
And the NBA has done the same thing. They've done a great job of bringing on board a great colleague, Bill Parham, who is heading up for the NBPA, their mental health initiative for a lot of their player association members, as well as the NBA has now started hiring on clinicians to be a part of each organization. And so there's a lot of great work that's being done. You're just not hearing about it.
Brent, really good point there. Could the NFL, again, I'm taking this from interviews that I've read, you know, fairly recently about NFL players who say they talk a good game, but it's really a culture that you keep this to yourself. And I mean, I was reading something that Randy Gregory of the Dallas Cowboys said, it's trash, it's punitive. That's my experience. Do you see that the NBA is doing something that the NFL might learn from here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the step that the NBA took in hiring Parham as a director of mental health and well-being is a critical first step, because it's very complicated at the professional level. Because if you take a professional athlete, first of all, within the team, it's a challenge, because if you have a player who is seeking out help and the organization knows, when it comes time to renegotiate that contract, that information is there, unfortunately. And I've actually had GMs tell me that, you know, if I have that information, that does influence the negotiation process, as bad as that is. That's why the director of mental health and well-being position that Parham stepped into in the NBA is so critical because it's an outside resource. Because the other thing that happens for a professional athlete is it's not as simple as you just simply walk into a psychologist's office because there are a lot of people that are going to, number one, see you go in there. There are going to be people that are sitting in that waiting room. It's just not that simple. So having that confidential resource that can even exist within the organization, or that's where the Players Association and the leagues get involved, it is a difficult issue to manage, just because my experience in working with players at the professional level is that there is a huge concern of who knows my business, who knows what's going on, and is there anything that can be used against me in a negotiation? And the reality is that, and full disclosures of, and I don't blame them, I understand it's human nature when someone in administration knows about someone's mental health past, for better or worse, that is part of the negotiation process.
We had a listener on Twitter who was curious about information on that mental health aid. It is mentalhealthfirstaid.com. You should get more information on that. To Mark in Minneapolis. Hi, Mark. Hey, thanks so much for waiting.
Yes, good morning.
Morning. What's your own experience with this? You were a coach?
I was a 25-year college coach. I live with mental illness myself, and I, like a previous caller, am a mental health first aid instructor because of the fact that I think we just need to do more education with coaches to be able to be comfortable with the conversation, to know what signs to look for. And, you know, we do a very good job in the sports industry with physical trainers and mm-hmm. physical issues. Mm-hmm. But once it comes to mental issues, that's where we really drop the ball. So I just think we need to continue to educate from the top down, administrators, coaches, everybody, to know that it's okay, to hear that it's held against people because, you know, of their mental health. You know, we don't hold it against them as much for physical health.
Right. And
those things are much more accepted. We have to accept the mental health part of it and get those people health, help.
I mean, Mark, when you talk to athletes in college and high school about this, right, don't you sense that there is still a stigma for all of the support that we've been talking about this hour? There's a lot of consequences to coming forward about this kind of thing, too. I mean, look at what's going to happen to Everson Griffin here. This will be forever in the minds of fans or potential teams that might want him to play.
Oh, and I agree with that. But I also think the more we have this conversation, the more we normalize it. We've seen that in the NHL. There's a goaltender with the New York Islanders who took a leave last year, mm-hmm. Was diagnosed with bipolar. And again, he had a lot of negative things being said about him in the past because he was hiding that. So nobody knew what was going on, just that this person was acting out, so he's a bad teammate or this or that. Once they figured out it was bipolar, it kind of explained it. He's getting the help. He got re-signed by the Islanders, which I think was a great move to show that. Mm-hmm. So the Kevin Loves, these people that are coming out, are helping normalize it. And for people to understand that once you get the help, you can function. It doesn't define the person. Once they get the help, they can go back to participating and performing like their abilities are.
You know, Angel, Brent mentioned this at the beginning of the discussion, the athletes who have come out about it. Talk to me a little bit about why that's so powerful.
Well, it's definitely cathartic, number one, when you are able to have a sense of release. I think also it kind of goes back to that fishbowl culture that I mentioned earlier, where, you know, there are lots of people that are on the outside looking in who assume that they know what's going on with you, but they really have no complete idea. And so once you have not only acknowledge that there is something that's going on with you, but you are also able to express that and express it without shame, without any humiliation attached to it, it's a very cathartic, freeing experience. One of my really close friends, I know that we talked a lot about some of the men in sports, but one of my really close friends who was actually the catalyst for me even going back and getting my doctorate in sport and performance psychology, Shamiqua Holtzclaw. That is now her platform that she uses, and she goes around the nation talking about her struggles with eventually what is now, you know, been diagnosed and confirmed as bipolar disorder. And talking about her journey in terms of, you know, seeking services and seeking help earlier on in her career as a collegiate athlete and not really taking the services that were available on campus at that time very seriously because of the stigma that was attached to being seen going into the sports psychologist's office on campus and things of that nature. Going out into the community and trying to seek services only to find and be, you know, almost disappointed with the fact that the clinician has Googled her or found out who she was and then all of a sudden treated her different in the therapy room, where now she's in a position where she feels like she has to perform for this therapist and can't be 100% vulnerable.
Wow.
And then moving on forward and really being able to find and speak her truth and share her experiences on a public platform has been a tremendous help for her in terms of moving the needle of the conversation and being an advocate and being affiliated with different mental health, behavioral health organizations that really use that platform to not only educate people, but to also help people access the resources that are necessary. And so the cathartic experience that comes with acknowledging what's going on with you, number one. And then number two, it's also an accountability measure because now, as I say many times before, with increased awareness begets increased responsibility to do something with it. And now it's not a shame-filled experience. It's now my truth, my lived experience, and those who are within my purview have to do something with it, and they can no longer just dismiss me.
You know what I was thinking about that, Brent? It's powerful what Angel says about this, but the athletes that you've primarily named and the ones that I've mentioned are high performers. I wonder if we're still not in that place where you can be a pretty good athlete and still, you know, feel like this is something that you can tell. I mean, Kevin Love still performs at a very high level. So in some ways, he's indemnified against a lot of the assumptions, the wrong assumptions that we make about this. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, you know, to me, that is the greatest thing that's come out of this. If you take Shamiqua, Kevin, DeMar DeRozan, and Everson, they are all all-star caliber, best of the best players.
That's a good point. You're saying on the other side of that,
yeah.
Look at this.
Because I think what that shows is you can deal with mental health and you can still perform at a high level. But then additionally, from a role model standpoint, it also, because and Kevin Love mentioned this, his agent questioned, are you sure you want to become the face of mental health?
Really?
Because there's a danger associated with that. But for the willingness to do that and what Shamiqua's doing, that then sets a role model example that, hey, it's okay to seek help. Seeking help is actually a strength. And what it also shows is that when you get help, not only are you able to perform athletically, but personally, you're just in a better space. So I see it as a huge positive so that it lets everybody know, because the high-level performers are doing it. I think in the sports organization, in that sports world, it's important that people get help, not only personally, first and foremost, we know that, but from the athletic stigma side of it, it also shows that it is important to get help regardless of who you are, and it can impact anybody.
Kim says on Twitter, my daughter was a student athlete who suffered from extreme anxiety, which spiraled into depression. The student may not recognize that they're actually suffering from depression. My daughter had no idea. And Matt says, love the conversation. I'm an athletic trainer at a Division III college. We've developed a mental health protocol to address athletes' mental health issues and to be a confidential and open resource for our student athletes. Angel, are colleges ahead of professional on this? Are high schools, ahead of the colleges? How would you put this?
I think the trend is moving towards really recognizing the necessity for the services that are needed. I think any college that has, you know, been able to garner out the funding to fund a position that is in-house is amazing. I think I have a great opportunity here at Mississippi State because I am officially embedded within our sports medicine department.
Yeah, so right. That's key, isn't it?
That is definitely key, because I have a pulse of what's going on over here. And I also have a dotted line relationship with our campus-based partners, whether it's the student counseling services department or our site clinic that's on campus. And so we have a long way to go. I would not be remiss if I didn't say that, you know, even with developing the position, it's one thing. It's another thing to be staffed, you know, and rightfully so, with clinicians who, one, can understand the clinical aspects, but also, two, understanding the sport culture. That can't be lost in translation either. And I think Mr. Walker can agree with me on this. Like, it takes – this is a unique population. There has to be cultural competence when it comes to working with an athlete and a performer, because the, you know, the reality is there are certain measures and certain interventions that you might do from a clinical standpoint that gets them to a point where they're okay from a well-being standpoint, but also can have a detrimental effect on their ability to perform well.
Ah.
And so, you know, having someone who has the understanding and the training and the competence to be able to manage both mm-hmm. sides as a holistic person, I think, is extremely necessary. From a university standpoint, there are different models that different universities are approaching. Some have outside consultants that provide the work. Some have inside providers, and some just use community-based services. From a professional standpoint, obviously the resources and allocation of those resources are better. And so when they do put programming in place, it tends to be a little bit stronger and firmer because you have access to way more resources. From a high school standpoint, you know, it's give or take. It depends on the region. It depends on the demographic. It depends, again, on the resources and opportunities for boosters to contribute to that. And so, you know, that's a tough question to answer. Again, you know, the needle is moving, but we're very far behind the curve.
Angel, really good to have you on the show. Thanks much.
Thank you.
Brent, I have about a minute left. Progress enough in the collegiate area that you're part of?
Yeah, I think Brian Hainline has been hired as a chief medical officer for the NCAA in 2013, and he's really promoted mental health. I think at the high school level, it's more difficult. There's not as much funding there. But if you have parents out there who are looking for resources because you're obviously organizationally, there's not as much support, I would recommend people go to the Association for Applied Sports Psychology's website, which is appliedsportpsych.org. And they have a link there to find a certified mental performance consultant. And back to what Angela was saying, these are people that are certified to deal with sport populations. So that's a resource that people can utilize, because obviously at the NCAA professional level, we have greater funding opportunities, but it hasn't quite filtered down to the high school level as yet.
Brent, I really appreciate the time and the insight.
Thank you much.
And Janet says on Twitter, 2 years ago, my son's junior league hockey coach made a big deal of his housing mom finding his lithium. As a talented hockey player living out of state with families, this was devastating to him. He came home and hung up his skates before spiraling downward. I appreciate the candor from everyone who called and the good questions. And if you missed the show, you can go back and listen to it on the podcast. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.